Next case on our calendar is 96-764, 96-852. Ingrid E. Holt, Executrix versus Grange Mutual Casualty Company. Mr. Weisenfelder.
Watch your time there.
Which case are you citing this to?
Wood versus Shepherd.
Wood versus Shepherd. Who do you represent? And who do you represent?
Your Honor, in that case, well...
You represent the insurance company that now finds that's their best authority.
Your Honor,
isn't that interesting? But isn't that case right? If it's an insured.
Insured.
Sure, and there was no insured here.
Correct.
Okay, do you agree?
Your Honor, what I'm trying to do is point out history, what has transpired and why we're here today. Because even though when the court made that decision, that precise issue was not before the court, but the court anticipated what was going to occur.
But if we had to put insured in there,
is why we're here today.
If we had to put insured in there, you wouldn't have been able to even come forward with your argument, would you?
Well, Your Honor...
Let's leave that for a minute. On page 5 of your brief, footnote 1, you say the adult sons of Holt arguably could have pursued Sexton-type claims under their own respective policies.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because here you have an insured tortfeasor, right?
Correct.
Okay. The people who are claiming are not insurers under the decedent's policy.
Correct.
They have their own policy, separate and apart from that. And if they do, then they could claim under their own policy, if they could show any kind of damage. Being emancipated, that might be difficult. But if they could show damage, they are presumed to have suffered damage under the statute.
Correct.
So then they would have an underinsured claim against their own policy, is that right?
They do have a claim. There stands much criticism, comment, and at times even confusion as to the records or how decisions of this court were interpreted, particularly with regard to uninsured, uninsured motorist coverage. I'll stand here and quite candidly say that last several years, this court has expanded coverage. In certain respects, some of the same cases that have come back argued today as a basis as to why the adult sons should be included to be able to make a claim under this policy. Interestingly enough, and this is another case that I never thought would be arguing in favor of before this court is this a void decision. And again, you improve the tools with which to work, and you take what's failed.
Or maybe they were right.
We won't criticize that decision. It just makes my job a little tougher. Savoy, in 1993, reaffirmed, upheld the validity of this court's decision in Wood. And there he is, and I wasn't even going to mention this, but there is an aside. There's even aside from the direct language in the case that upholds the viability, reaffirms the court's decision in Wood. As this court was going through the analysis on the intra-family statute provision, it ruled that the husband and the wife did not stack the houses because of the intra-family provision, anti-statute provision. There is a note, like a sentence, that speaks in terms of the daughter. And the daughter, the court held, she cannot stack policies because she's only an insurer under one policy. Very indirectly, same thing in this case. We said, if you're not insured, you don't have a basis for standing in a certain claim.
So all these claims start with, all these cases start with, do they not, are you an insured under a policy? And if you are, the policy says if you're insured under the policy, you're entitled to recover, we pay.
Correct.
Fine.
Range, and I might as well raise your time on the two unreported court appeals decisions that, as far as I know, are the only decisions in this state that even remotely begin to justify this decision, and I think they are decisions to Keon and Lynch decision. First, in both Keon and Lynch, there was a strike in the State Farm policy that in essence eliminated anyone from recovering under policy. That's not the situation in this case. Grange is paid $250,000. The other thing is that Guillon and Lynch, never got to whether or not there were separate claims, there was only one claim asserted. Just in court, that Guillon and Lynch do not stand for the proposition in which they have decided. And any argument that they do is simply contrary to the holdings of this court, is inconsistent with those holdings of this court, and they're simply not good law. What we have here is a contract. The contract was by the deceased. The deceased paid premiums for the policy. The deceased, upon receiving the policy, it's clearly spelled out as to what is covered, who is covered, with regard to the family member, who is a family member, those persons residing in your household related by blood, marriage, whatever. That was the contract. And now, those not privy to that contract, those who paid no consideration for the contract, are making claims against the contract. At this time, I simply ask this court that the decision of the court below is incorrect.
I guess I've never asked in a case whether or not the principal party in interest, who is supported by an amicus, is prepared also to argue the amicus's position, since the amicus is arguing your position.
Your Honor, I spoke with counsel for amicus, and he decided prior to the day's argument
But you're familiar enough with their brief.
Pardon me?
You're familiar enough with their brief. Because on page 8 of their brief, they go through and say 39-37-18, unless the claim is insured under the policy, the arguments you've just made, and quote from Wood versus Shepherd. I was interested in this, to ask whether or not you agree with that. This holding, that would be Wood, is absolutely consistent with Sexton, which was a long time, even before I got here, I think, and In re Reek, which Justice Wright wrote in the state case. This holding is absolutely consistent with both Sexton and Reek, which each allowed wrongful death claims because the claimant wasn't insured. So you agree with that whole line of cases?
In Reek, the only one that I really care to comment on is because I think there was a dispute in Ray Reek as to whether or not...
That was just whether it was going to become an asset of the estate or and divide and, or divided among the beneficiaries.
Well, I mean, taking on behalf of the administrator or administrator's estate is divided among the wrongful death and statutory beneficiaries or estate. But I think there is a distinction in Reek in that the policy language in that case was different from what we had before.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Weisenfelder. Mr. Rainier.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, if it's permissible, we would request tonight to have 10 minutes of time to address the question.
Watch your time there on the clock so you leave time for Mr. Miller.
Your Honor, on behalf of the business holder in the courtroom here today, we certainly disagree with Grange's argument and we think it's misplaced. Legally, I think their arguments are based on a small bit of dicta in the Wood versus Shepherd decision, which is in fact not the main issue before the court in Wood. This issue has been more appropriately addressed in this court's subsequent decision and in a couple of court of appeals decisions that I will address. In State Farm versus Alexander, this court specifically held that an insurance company may not, by a policy definition, exclude what would be otherwise valid coverage. That is exactly what they did here. They have used their policy to define who is an insured. That definition limits greatly, they say, who they cover.
Let me, you submitted that comment in your brief. I didn't quite understand that. You mean an insurance company cannot by contract say who it is they are going, or it is going to insure. Is that your argument?
Not if it attempts to constrain what the statute permits.
How does the statute say that a policy cannot say that certain people will be insured and certain people will not? If you pay a premium and you're going to insure your whole family, you're going to insure yourself, you're going to insure your company, your employees. Isn't that part of the contract? I mean, how are they changing the law by saying who it is they're going to insure for a premium?
Because they are attempting to take out two parties who are wrongful death statutory beneficiaries who under the law are entitled to recovery.
But that doesn't say anything about insurance, does it? The wrongful death doesn't relate to whom it is that the insurance company can contract to say is an insured, does it?
No, it does not, but the wrongful death statute provides the procedure by which wrongful death proceeds are distributed.
Right.
And they are trying to limit that by saying, no, the wrongful death beneficiaries under that statute cannot recover. I don't think it's any different than Market versus Western or some of these other. For example, the household exclusion. They used a definition in the policy of a household exclusion to exclude certain coverages. This court said, no, you can't do that. And this court has a series of cases that have prevented insurers from using definitional language or exclusions in their policy to reduce what the statute otherwise allows. I think the key in this case, though, comes down to the phrase, an insurer. And the Dion case, out of the Third Appellate District, took a different look at this than some of the other courts of appeals who have addressed it. Because what happened to Dion, you've got to remember, a man named Thomas Smith died. He lived alone. He was still by underinsured motorist. And State Farm said, well, he's dead, he's not insured. His personal representative, the state doesn't fit the definition of an insured. His ex-wife and his children who live over there aren't insurers. So guess what? Nobody recovered. You paid all these premiums, nobody recovered. And they refused his claim. So Dion looked at that, reported Dion, and they said, no, you're looking at it the wrong way. You're looking at the phrase "and insured" the wrong way. The decedent is the insured, not the beneficiaries. The decedent. The decedent is the named insured on the policy. The decedent is the one that suffered the injuries that led to his death. The decedent is the insured. Now, the decedent's dead. In theory, he's got the right to bring the wrongful death claim. How do you do it? Under Ohio law, the personal representative steps into the shoes of the decedent to make that claim. The personal representative is the only person under Ohio law who can bring that claim. The sole party who can bring that claim under Ohio law is the personal representative. That's where I think the problem is. The statute says, insurers, you are required to issue your policies protecting and insured against injury or death. Wayne Holt was the named insurer. He bought the policy, he paid the premium. He's the one that suffered the injuries that resulted in his death.
Okay, and if he stayed alive and been horribly injured instead, his underinsured coverage would have been what?
Well, it's interesting because the court announced that loss of consortium is a separate claim, so it depends on whether that applies in this case or not. If it's an injury case, his claim, the law at that time, would have been the single per person limit because he's the only party that was injured. But the statute, the legislature in the state has said when you're killed, these people are the ones who take that recovery. And this court has said in Savoy, each one of those people has a separate claim subject to the per-person limitation. The personal administrator of the estate of Plain Holt is making this claim. Not the two sons, the personal administrator of the estate. And that administrator under the Wrongful Death Act and the Underinsured Motor Statute is entitled to recover the full amount of this coverage. Grange asked the court to read the word insured in the statute as meaning the sons. We disagree with that. Our position, considering all of the public policy now pronounced by this court regarding underinsured motors coverage, the requirement liberal construction to effectuate the intent of the legislation. And pursuant to Alexander, that you can't, by definition, limit coverage, this court should adopt the rationale of the 3rd and 12th District Courts of Appeal. Now, I would also mention that the 1st District Court of Appeal is a 3rd court that's also gone this way. In the case of Mann versus State Farm, they allow the parents of an emancipated daughter to cover under the emancipated daughter's policy.
Okay, I'm interested in mechanically you prevail. But what happens in that way? I mean, what do you prove?
It's like any other wrongful death, Your Honor. You prove, you bring in witnesses, family members. They testify to the court as to their damages. The jury awards a lump sum award of damages
to
the estate.
It's not one award.
To the personal representative.
Right.
Then you go to the court, the probate court,
right,
who then looks at the Wrongful Death Act and has a hearing if necessary and divides those funds among the various statutory beneficiaries.
Okay, now given your fact pattern, let's say you prove a loss of $1 million. What do you think the probate court is likely to do with respect to the adult emancipated children?
Well, first of all, we would be limited to $500,000.
I understand that. Okay, but you prove the loss exceeds the whatever limit you want to put on it. Now you go to the probate court. All right.
what I'm hearing.
Okay, but isn't it possible, say you've got 500,000, you just, everybody agrees that's what you're fighting. Isn't it possible that probably, of course, not award all of that to the winner?
I don't know at that point, Your Honor. I've never seen any case law that constrains the probate court by virtue of the limits of the insurance policy to only give X amount of dollars to one party or the other. I presume, without any guidance on that issue from any court that I've ever seen.
But, I mean, isn't that sort of the trap here? I mean, I understand your argument for abstention. The end result could be pushed up beyond per person to per occurrence level. And then the end result is still going to be that the court looks at the fact pattern, who's making the claims, and this all ought to go, except for a nominal amount, there is no, you didn't prove expectancy of impairments, which is, I've never understood quite how you prove that anyway. So it should all go to the widow.
I understand what the court's saying, and perhaps the way to handle that is for this court to give some guidance and its opinion in this case as to what the probate court should do under those circumstances. Is the probate court then constrained to go back and look at the insurance company's limits and say, no, we have to limit the widow to X amount of dollars? I don't know. There's no authority I know of in the law that tells the probate court how to handle it. And I guess that is one potential outcome.
It seems to me the problem is, from the standpoint of just being trying to be prepared for all this, and trying to provide coverage to folks who maybe ought to be covered, is that the potential is here that when you're dealing with emancipated adult children that you're pushing the amount of insurance in play up, and ultimately it's going to go to that single beneficiary because it's a two-step process, because that's what the law provides for. Where if it were a one-step process, the insurance companies, say you put the $500,000 play, but you also have the per person limitation. They might still be looking at $250,000 and change.
You may be right. I certainly think at the present time, the probate court would look at the Savoy case, and you, because that's really the only close authority that we have on that issue.
You have a somewhat different situation in terms of the beneficiaries.
That's correct. But it still says that there's a per person limitation, and you're right, the original guidance. I would like to turn this over to Mr. Miller to complete the argument. I would just quote one section of the Savoy decision to the court very briefly, if I can. In Savoy, this court stated, and I quote, "The purchase of full uninsured, underinsured coverage is the only possible means for responsible motorists to protect themselves and their families."
Thank you, Mr. Rainier. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm glad that Grange, in the amicus brief, raises the issue of the purpose of the underinsured motorist coverage. There are two reasons for underinsured motorist coverage. The first is to protect yourself and people in the car when you sustain a personal injury. The second purpose is, for purchasing this type of insurance, is to protect the beneficiaries in the event that you die in this particular case, in the event of the death of an insured. And I use the word insured because in this particular case, that is the trigger word that you have to look at each policy. It's like an environmental policy, it's a trigger. The insured in this case was Wayne Holt. The executrix of the estate of Wayne Holt, by definition in the policy, is not an insured. So if they're the only person, that's the dilemma that can present the claim.
Counsel, let me push you on up. Let's assume you're trying to wrong with that case. Let's not be worried about insurance.
All right.
As a matter of strategy, are you going to put on all the adult emancipated children and tell the jury that they ought to, award X number of dollars for each one of these adult emancipated children, or are you going to focus on the widow?
I'm going to do both. I'm going to put on the widow, and you remember the statute when it was revised in, and I believe, 86, it now allows for the pain, suffering, and mental anguish.
Sure.
The children, even though you're emancipated, still have that opportunity to have mental anguish. And I have tried cases, and I have presented every, and I have tried again, and everyone has testified in that case. And that's where the jury comes up with a total award for the administrator.
Counsel, in the Sparks case, they argued to us that that the tort action didn't really matter. It was the contract and the contract language that controlled. It seems to me you're trying to argue the exact opposite point, that it doesn't matter what the contract says in the contract, it's the tort action now that controls. How do you reconcile your position with what was just argued to us more than an hour ago?
I disagree. And it's interesting, Spring Bedfellows, we have State Farm, and I would remind you that you made a stay order on the 15th of January in the case of Yepko versus State Farm, and State Farm takes the same position that we take in this particular case, that the only person that can present the claim is the personal representative against the policy for the...
You're not answering my question. I'm wanting to know how you can say, on this case, you should ignore the contract, yet Sparks is arguing you should honor the contract.
I see it to be inconsistent. In the first case that I listened to this morning, the deceased in that particular case, through the administrator, signed a release with the tortfeasor in 1992, as I understand.
And they're saying that doesn't matter because the contract says these people have their own claims.
Yes.
And you're saying the contract doesn't matter because these people, because they're not insured. The tort action controls because they're defined as insured under the wrongful death statute.
I wouldn't argue that way this morning. I'll tell you why. The issue also that nobody addressed was that State Farm was placed on that release by State Farm. What consideration was State Farm given in that case? Because State Farm came in and said, wait a minute, the only person who can present a claim in this case is the personal representative, and they have signed the release, releasing the tortfeasor, who we insured, and, oh, excuse me, you also released the State Farm. And my argument in that case would have been there was absolutely no consideration whatsoever of releasing State Farm in that particular case, but that argument was never set forth. I would still say that only the personal representative can argue, and I'm sorry, that can present a claim for the benefit of the surviving spouse and next of kin.
In this case, did your clients have an uninsured policy on their own?
My clients? Yes, the Grange policy was for Mr. and Mrs.
I know about the Grange policy. I'm asking you if the two adult...
I want to address that, Your Honor.
Well, we don't have time. I just want to know, did your clients have an uninsured motorist policy? Separate and apart from this policy.
One did and one did not.
Okay. Now, if they both had, might you argue what was argued this morning?
If they both had underinsured policy, no, I still wouldn't argue that.
So you think you have no claim against the independent insurance policy?
No, because the insured, by definition, okay, doesn't trigger the... And that's what the insurance company is going to argue when you decide this case. They're going to come back and say,
I understand.
The insured is only the deceased.
So your position is that if we take the position you have to be an insured in a wrongful death case, following what Wood versus Shepherd says, that your clients are out entirely, even if they have an underinsured motorist coverage policy themselves, where the statute says they're presumed to have suffered damage.
Yes, I'm sorry, but I have to take one position or the other, and I say they recover under the Grange policy through the administrator or executrix, not through their policy.
Why are those positions inconsistent? Why couldn't you say that we're entitled to one or the other?
Because House Bill 20 is probably pending right now, has changed it.
That doesn't have anything to do with today.
Well, I find it inconsistent.
Okay.
Personally, and the problem in this case is if you accept that definitionally, argument in this particular case, then you've eliminated any person, like a widow or widower, living alone. My father is still in an automobile accident. I recovered.
I got my answer. Thank you.
And you've used your time.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Weidenfelder, you've saved about 4.5 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Two points I wish to address. At the outset, there was a good argument that the Alexander case would be topical. Well, Alexander, for two reasons, has absolutely no application in this case. Alexander was arguing in this court the basis that what happened in Alexander is the same thing that occurred here, and not in front of the jury. That's wrong. Alexander dealt with a situation where there was an existing insurer under the policy. Alexander was involved in an accident because of an exclusion in the policy. The insurer was then excluded from coverage. In this case, we don't get to that point because neither of the adult sons qualified as insured. Secondly, Alexander was decided in 1992. If there was any doubt as to whether or not Wood versus Shepherd was still good law, that was laid to rest a year later when this court decided Savoy again, requiring that a person be insured. Finally, this is a contract. It's a contract issue. Contracts at times breed harsh results, but that's the real world. People have to know when they enter into a contract, whether it be an insurance company or whether it be an insurer, what the rights are, what the obligations are under that policy. The two adult sons are strangers to that policy. They didn't contract for that policy. They didn't pay premiums for that policy. The benefits of that policy occur to the decedent and the widow. The language was quite clear. Who were insured under the policy at the time he purchased it. It's that simple. And again, I would ask this court to reverse the judgment of the Council Street and enter judgment based on the range. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weisfelder. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.